Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Uplift Fit Nutrition Radio. Today, I have Sarah Amadon. She's the owner of Root and Fruit Nutrition, and she's a fellow dietitian, so I'm super stoked. I love having fellow RDs on here. Woohoo! So, you guys, we're going to get nerdy today, and I'm very stoked to talk about today's topic, all about nutrigenomics. We're talking about genes, the impact on our bodies, on the ability to utilize nutrients, metabolize, methylate, you name it. So Sarah, thank you so much for coming on my podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Lacey. I'm really excited to be here.
Now tell me, of course, I have to ask real fast, what got you into this field?
Well, I think just some of the personal health challenges that I had in my 20s and 30s. I was a Division I volleyball player, been an athlete all my life. And then there was just a series of events that really pushed me down into poor digestion and multiple autoimmune diseases and chronic infections and postpartum challenges. And I got to the end of my rope, really, with health. And I was like, no one can help me. I went to the ER. I saw, you know, GI specialists, and they really were scratching their heads, handing me medication, or said, I'm so sorry, I can't help you. And I was like, okay, well, what do I do now? Clearly, I'm kind of on my own in this realm. And I had a functional medicine practitioner who said, let's take a look at your genes. So that was really the beginning of this journey for me to go, wow, to hold this report in my hand and go, this explains so much. And to be able to then take steps with informed, knowledgeable, evidence-based practice, really, on my own before I became a practitioner myself. So it's just been a long journey of personal health that I decided that this was going to be something I wanted to pursue. So that's kind of how I got interested in it.
Love that. I'm all about a story and your background helping to really support and understand people as well. So let's talk about the topic. What is nutrigenomics? I know a lot of people are like, okay, nutri and genome. There's something here with nutrition and genes.
Yeah, absolutely. So nutrigenomics, or nutritional genomics, as if we want to break those two words down into two words, the relationship between our DNA and genome with nutrition. So this can also involve other environmental exposures, which ultimately do impact our nutrition status. And as dietitians, we know there's a lot of things that impact nutrition status. So as you've talked about, Lacey, with your exposure to mold in the past, what that has done to your body, eventually there's a depletion of nutrients that we have to allocate to deal with the mold or other exposures that impact our nutrition status. So then later on down the road, we see a change in gene expression as a result. So how does food impact our gene expression? And that's the heart of nutrigenomics. So if we have a lot of processed or inflammatory foods, it might lead either to a lack in nutrient density, or we'll again have to allocate available nutrients in order to deal with the inflammation and the downstream gene expression. So it's a practice that looks at an individual's biochemistry. So that's the nerdy part of the day. And we can take a cheek swab, very simple, look at the medical literature to determine what single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, are what we call them, and how they're indicated for health or disease, and depending on that patient or the client's symptoms and the health status of that patient. So just because you have a gene for something does not mean it's expressing. So we might hear, I have the breast cancer gene, I have the Alzheimer's gene, but that doesn't mean that that is your destiny. So our lifestyle, our environment can have a positive or a negative impact on our gene expression. And that is the essence of epigenetics. And so taking your genetics into account, adding in the environment and the lifestyle, and out pops your health and whatever that looks like. So as we like to say, the genes load the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. Your food has all the ingredients, the building blocks to keep your biochemistry running smoothly, kind of like cogs in a machine. So what happens if we don't eat a variety of foods, or we lack in certain nutrients? Or are there challenges to the absorption of those nutrients?
Mm-hmm. I love that. And there's also like a twofold part to this, right? So we have nutrigenomics, and then we have nutrigenetics, in which nutrigenomics is looking at, you know, the effects of nutrients on our gene expression. And then nutrigenetics is looking at how those genes are responding to the nutrients or the food or the supplementation. So kind of like a twofold, but they all go together here. And just because we have one gene, like you said, doesn't mean that that gene is going to be active. It doesn't mean it's going to be increased or decreased specifically in activity, because there's so much more to the story there, right? What load, like we have the gun that's loaded, but what caused that trigger? Diet, lifestyle, even supplementation. Not just that. I mean, we're talking about environmental toxins, mold, heavy metals, like so many things that can impact our genetic expression.
Absolutely.
So many things to get into the weeds of. So how is this different from genetic counseling? So there's, you guys, there's a lot of different, and I want to say first and foremost, don't get too excited right here, right now, because we are still in the baby weeds of the science of nutrigenomics and nutrigenetics. But let's talk about how can we apply this data and how is this different from genetic counseling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that was the area I initially wanted to go in. So postpartum, after both my babies, 3 months postpartum, I just had issues digesting my food. So I would have cramps for 3 or 4 hours and I didn't really understand what was going on. Had my gallbladder removed after my first baby. And then 3 months postpartum after my second baby, the same thing happened. And I was like, wait a second, I don't have an organ to take out to fix this problem. So initially when I saw my gene report, I was like, okay, how do I practice this? This is so amazing. So I met with a director of a genetic counseling program in 2017 to discuss if this might be the right path for me with, if I wanted to go back to school. And she said at the time, and this may have changed, that the three main things that genetic counseling focuses on is pediatric, prenatal, or oncology genetics. So a lot of those health conditions are determined by genetics and can't be changed. So DNA, gene addition or deletions, inborn errors of metabolism, so things your infant may be tested for in the womb or at birth, or to determine like a risk for a type of cancer or the severity of a cancer. So that's kind of the genetics realm. And honestly, I felt a little disheartened after that meeting because I was like, well, I feel like I'm going to be giving bad news to people all day. That doesn't, how do I empower people to take control and make changes in their diet or lifestyle to improve their health and not necessarily what's predetermined. And so the director was like, honestly, I think you're going to be really unhappy, you know, doing this program, because I don't think that's what you're talking about, but what you're talking about sounds so cool. So please come back and tell me what you end up doing. And so that was really encouraging to just go, this isn't the right path for you, but keep looking. So the nutrigenomics looks at that epigenetics, so the impact of our environment and lifestyle on our genes, taking into account all of the things that can have a role in nutrition status, many of which you discuss on your podcast or you've already mentioned today. So like stress, big player. I mean, even coming into an interview, I feel stressed, my digestion changes, sleep, trauma, endocrine disruption, toxic exposures, and then nutrient density in food or lack thereof. Movement is a huge one, just getting moving and not even necessarily like joining a team or joining a gym, just moving our bodies need it, and the physical activity to signal our genome to function in a certain way.
Well, you do not sound nervous whatsoever, and you're doing a fantastic job. So I hope your parasympathetic system can activate now.
Right? That vagus nerve, man, we got to keep it going.
I know. So you talked about, you know, some of the things that in regards to genetic counseling, genetic testing. And then of course we have the ancestry, the 23andMe. We have a lot of things like that. And then we also have Stratagene or Rhonda Patrick's website in which we can look at our SNPs as well. So when you're looking at testing and you're looking at addressing or finding out, okay, first and foremost, what are the genes specifically, not how are they expressing, but what are the genes? What is the first type of testing or what company, what do you prefer to use?
I think that the tests that are may or may not offer the kind of evidence-based SNPs that have an impact on human metabolism. So ancestry or 23andMe DNA testing, they're inexpensive, yes, but A, you have to run them through an interpretation software, mm-hmm. which may or may not put your private health information out there in the world, and it might not be encrypted. So there's kind of additional hurdles to jump over. B, you have to find a practitioner who will be willing to comb through potentially hundreds of unknown or unresearched genetic information. We just don't know yet what's relevant. So just to find some SNPs that are somewhat understood and might have an impact. And then C, many companies like this that offer low-cost genetic testing have a relationship with pharmaceutical companies. They might sell your genetic information to create drugs to market to you later. So some people are okay with that. That's totally fine. I just think it's important to distinguish and be upfront that a lot of nutrigenomics practitioners do not use an Ancestry or 23andMe raw data, though some do.
And I think the most important thing too is, like, how are they interpreting and using your data to develop the quote unquote protocols that they did develop? Because there you do have maybe a gene for insulin resistance does not mean, or you have a gene for increased risk of cardiovascular disease does not mean that you need to be on a low carb, high fat diet, right? That's something that I noticed. I don't remember the company. I need to bring it up, but I've done two different companies because I am such a nerd for this too. And I kid you not, the things that they popped up, like the things that they recommended for me, I was like, I could not survive on this as an athlete, as you know, somebody who's done the work in bodybuilding and developed my metabolism, I would waste away. So just very, very important to recognize, like, when you are doing these types of things and these types of, like, protocols are made, they need to truly be read by a practitioner or a clinician. Do not go based off of just a protocol and an algorithm that's just shot at.
I absolutely agree with you. And that's why I pursued it myself, is because I dug into the medical literature on my own, but I did have some help with some of my mentors and people I look up to in the nutrigenomics field who've really blazed the trail and led the way to trying to better understand it. So there's a lot of direct to consumer tests that are available out there. Mm-hmm. But honestly, if you look at a gene report and you see all the letters and you see the RS numbers, you're like, what do I even, like, how is this even relevant? It's just a bunch of letters and numbers. Right. So if you have a trained practitioner who knows how to decipher and interpret these tests, then you really have found gold. And so that's something that, you know, I love about Amanda Archibald, and I've looked up to her for many years with her genomic kitchen work. And she has some amazing courses for practitioners out there that are mentorship and trying to advance and incorporate nutrigenomics into your practice. Because as she likes to say, our genes are a signpost. And so they give us a direction to look in, as opposed to kind of playing guesswork. It's like, okay, well, let's run these labs. They're all normal. But what if we get to the end and everything that we've known to run as far as, like, labs or testing comes back mostly normal? And those are the kinds of patients and clients that I would say, well, let's take a look at your genes, because that can reveal just one or two really subtle changes to make that can make all the difference and have a really good return on ingestion, as she likes to say.
Now, can we talk about some of those specific genes? There are some that I've talked about in my podcast before. So we've talked about, like, MTHFR in regards to methylation. We've talked about COMT in regards to downregulation or methylation and how you process your neurotransmitters and your estrogen. But can we talk about some other ones, like the FUT2 or the PEMT, a couple other things that are involved with, you know, how we process nutrients, how we methylate, you name it. What are the top ones that you like to talk about?
Yeah, I think you mentioned, you know, the two of the big ones, the MTHFR is kind of, we call it the gateway gene, where it's like, everyone's kind of heard of it. And we also need to keep into perspective that one gene is not going to make or break you. We need to look at kind of the whole pathway as a whole. So MTHFR is just one leapfrog of many that might need to be taken care of. So I like to look at the PEMT gene. I think that it's sort of an up and comer with regards to choline metabolism. And we're seeing a lot of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease today. And there's people who, again, it's non-alcoholic, so they're not drinking much. But why is that expressing in such a way as to cause a fatty liver? And there might be issues with absorption and metabolism of choline there. And I have a really interesting story with a friend who had just had a new baby, was still struggling with high bilirubin. And I was like, hey, let me just take a look at your genes again. I still had her report, and I like glaring popped out on her page was her PEMT, homozygous SNPs. I was like, you know what? I think you could just supplement with some choline and let's see what happens. And so for weeks, I think he was 6 weeks old at the time, still had high bilirubin, and she supplemented with choline. And within a week or two, his bilirubin went to back down to normal. And so just by breastfeeding and her supplementing choline at that time helped support her son's metabolism of choline as well, to be able to support the liver and bring that bilirubin down into the normal range. And so it was really interesting to watch and just be like, this is my hunch here. Let's take a look at that. And his pediatrician was really surprised and was like, let me write this down. What is this? What just happened? So it's just a really interesting PEMT story.
I absolutely love that. Any other cool stories that you could share with us?
Yeah, I think the FUT2 gene is one that has been maybe the bane of my existence. So this one, I mean, everyone talks about MTHFR, but I find that some people call it FUT2. I usually pronounce the letters, but FUT2 can impact your gut dysbiosis or the secretion of oligosaccharides into the gut. And so that can impact your B12 status, whether you're absorbing it well, and perhaps you're not. So if we do have a gut dysbiosis as a result of FUT2, for me, that impacted my breastfeeding children and their guts at the time too. So there was some research I had read about baby's gut being a reflection of mom's gut. And some of that is related to FUT2 and the oligosaccharides that we may or may not be passing on in our breast milk to our infants. And so I was really sick at the time when I was breastfeeding both of my kids, and they had pretty unhappy guts too, like, you know, reflux and just really uncomfortable throughout a lot of their infancy. So if we're able to focus on microbiome and gut metabolism there, we can then improve absorption of other nutrients later on down the line. So I struggle with pernicious anemia, and some of that is related to FUT2. And so it's been interesting to kind of look at my own gene report and go, okay, well, how can I help other people by better understanding my own metabolism? And I think it's such a great way to have hands-on practice for health practitioners that are interested in nutrigenomics, is to go, okay, let's start with your own gene report so that you can see, hey, I noticed that I respond this way to these foods, or I respond this way to fitness and exercise. It takes me longer to recover from a workout than it does most people. So I would love to go into more sports nutrition, incorporating a gene report to say, hey, it would benefit you more to have an extra day of rest than to train, and to also, you know, either supplement or focus on these foods that help reduce your oxidative stress. Ooh. And that's something I know, right? I know you're probably like, wow, I hadn't even thought about a use of that for a gene report. But as a former Division I athlete, I was trained like a football player because we didn't know any better then. So it doesn't help to have a bulky volleyball player when we got to jump. But we also didn't have a dietitian on staff at the time. And so what if we took these reports and we incorporated it for, you know, high performance teams, Olympic teams, university teams, to really optimize their health, optimize their nutrition status, and see results in their performance. Mm-hmm.
I love that. And I want to ask you about some of the specifics and some genes that you look at, but I want to throw in, because the immediate thing, when you say athlete, the first thing that I want to run to is the comp gene. So how we are, mm-hmm. you know, running through our epinephrine, norepinephrine, yes. and our estrogen, because if we have a sluggish comp, then that can cause us to slowly degrade those mm-hmm. fight or flight hormones. And then we're more prone to stress. So we might need to work out less, to focus more on stress reduction strategies, to take more deloads. So when you are like the first, you don't have to give your secrets, but what are the things that you like to look at most with training and fitness?
I think we see a lot of just high histamine in okay. athletes. Some of that could be the COMT, because histamine is also a neurotransmitter. So what you're saying is neurotransmitters coming in versus neurotransmitters going out? Mm-hmm. Are we making enough? Are we eating enough to be able to make those neurotransmitters? But then once they're in the body, are we able to clear them so that we're not overwhelmed and so those neurotransmitters don't get so high? But I think it's really easy to ignore some of the symptoms that our athletes might be coming in and talking to us about if they're feeling flushed or overly fatigued, not recovering very quickly. I know for those who may be struggling with being overweight, they may say, hey, you know what? When I work out, I feel really bad. Like I don't feel good. And so when I hear that, I think, okay, we have a histamine issue here. So because when you exercise, histamines are moving around, things are trying to detox, right? So addressing potentially focusing on diet first, things that are less inflammatory with regards to food, so that we can then get people moving and so that they don't feel so bad when they're working out, right? So as far as just getting a normal person up and moving around, addressing things like COMT, DAO is another one with regards to histamine, to be able to get them to a place where they're functioning better, detoxing better, and then overall increasing in their health and performance.
Now, for the histamine in particular, are you talking about like the NAT2 or is there a different one?
I think I see DAO the most, okay. But you could potentially have HLA, DQ, SNPs involved there too with regards to metabolism. But yeah, I mean, it really depends on the client, like what I would look at their genes first and then kind of get a rundown of how they're feeling and what their day-to-day diet, exercise, lifestyle is like, because it's very individual. And if there's a lot of stress and trauma, that might be more beneficial to address even more than food or training, right? So overcoming things with our mind first and taking care of ourselves and our minds to be able to then process what might be an overwhelming or underwhelming amount of neurotransmitters.
I love you. You guys, Sarah is the bomb.com, because we cannot heal in a stressed out negative environment. We really, absolutely. Really can't. You can't throw ashwagandha at a stressed out, underfed, fight or flight body. Mm-hmm. And that's going to work. So love that. Now, when it comes down to, you know, methylation, wanted to make sure, cause we didn't necessarily go over that, but can you tell my listeners like the importance of why it's just not genetics and why it's truly diet, lifestyle, supplementation, everything all together? Let's make sure that people truly understand it is not just what your genes output.
Yeah. I think my personal story really kind of points in that direction. If I'm in my, you know, 20s and 30s and struggling with digestion, autoimmune disease, and malabsorption, what's going on there? How did I get to that point if I was a healthy athlete at one point? So just having a perfect storm of variables, nobody told me that birth control pills would deplete B vitamins. And now seeing my gene report, I go, oh, that makes so much sense. I was already had a challenge with metabolizing my B vitamins. So if you add in something that depletes them, you're going to continue to be deficient. So add in like a vaccine injury and inflammation that threw me into an autoimmune state without first having those B vitamins to deal with the inflammation. And then there's probably some mold exposure in there. And I also walked on like newly wet, clean carpet at a temporary apartment that we had moved into. And I felt so physically ill just from carpet chemicals. I stopped having a period for 10 months and developed Hashimoto's and pernicious anemia, PCOS. I had sensitivities to foods, allergies to the environment, and even like the silicone in my contact lenses and in my menstrual cups. I like couldn't even use those. So like to take a bunch of environmental triggers when you're already challenged with a potentially low B vitamin situation, how do you recover from that, right? So I think that taking into account where you're coming in nutrition status wise, then adding in the signpost with your gene report can really shed some light on the what do we do now. So people who might come to see me, I want to hear their stories. Like, what's your trauma like? What is your home life like? What is your diet like? Your movement like? And just trying to get a picture of, well, how did we get here? We didn't get here overnight, right? We have to look back at what potential triggers were involved in order to get a good picture of what steps to take moving forward. And sometimes, like for me, I just started like a methyl B complex, and within 2 days I could eat without cramping. So just flooding my body with good nutrients. And I don't recommend taking a bunch of supplements without consulting somebody. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing my functional medicine practitioner at the time. So, but we shouldn't be taking handfuls of supplements, and we should recognize that a supplement is what it says. It's to be supplemented to our diet. So having a food first approach the best that we can, but also recognizing that there's some amazing products out there that do have a therapeutic effect on the human body and our biochemistry to be able to recover from some of these really challenging health conditions.
It's truly amazing to see how some people respond to specific supplementation. Mm-hmm. I know, like for me, if I'm too much methylated, I tried to add in a methyl B12 like 3 weeks ago. Cause I was like, okay, my B12 levels look good, but they could be a tad bit better. Let me throw in a methyl. I was like, you know what? There's a chance, because I know I sluggishly methylate, there's a chance I develop anxiety. Literally within three mm-hmm. days, I was pissed off, angry at every single possibility. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can never do this again to myself. And then there's some people that take methyl B12 and they are the happiest, most calm, most energized individuals because they needed that extra methylation with their sluggish, with their poor methylation pathways. So, and of course, if they're deficient. So it really truly is like phenomenal. And then of course, I absolutely love seeing how people do with different like liver detoxification supplements, because as we know, that can greatly impact how our genes are expressed as well. And of course, how we're detoxifying, upregulating, downregulating different pathways in our body. So I just find it fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you said it well. The good news is there's so many ways you can go about treating a patient or a client. It's like, hey, this worked for client A, but client B is not really reacting as well as I'd like to see. There's about a dozen other options out there to try. And so what I don't want my future clients and patients to do, well, Sarah suggested this, it didn't work for me, and then not tell me. Please talk to me. Please come tell me, like, how does this make you feel? I like to ask, like, do you feel better, worse, or the same? Or to have a perspective, instead of demonizing certain foods, we can say good, better, best, you know, as opposed to necessarily good or bad, because someone may do fine on dairy or gluten or whatever, mm-hmm. and other people might not. So I don't like to just put everything in such an extreme boat, but I love to have like a good, better, best, where maybe you're cost prohibitive with something. I don't want to give you a bunch of tests to do and a bunch of labs to run when maybe you can't afford all of those things. So we have to prioritize what we can suggest and make recommendations based on the client and what they're able to do, feasibly do, both from a making changes perspective, as well as testing and confirming what our genetics are saying, confirm with lab work or other testing.
Right. Amen to that. And I just pulled up, I remembered, and I'm going to throw this company under the bus. But so I remember doing Geno Palette. And it freaking sucked. And I pulled it up to here, and it's like looking at all the nutrients that they recommended to me. And it's like, okay, they know nothing about what is going on in my body, what my past intake looks like, what my current intake looked like. They know nothing. So it's so important. And you've said this again and again, which I love, and we just got to reiterate. It's not just your current state. It's not just your genes. It's your past and what's going on now in diet, lifestyle, all that stuff. So,
absolutely. And I think that's why having a good practitioner is so important for a nutrigenomic interpretation, because if you look just at my report, methylation is the big one. I know this. B vitamins are crucial, but also my other highlighted in my genes are bone health and vascular health. Well, honestly, the best thing I could have done in my lifetime was be an athlete. So I'm regularly putting stress on my bones. I'm regularly playing beach volleyball doubles every, you know, couple of days. So this is one way that I'm able to sidestep what my genetics tell me and to take into consideration that this is epigenetic. This is putting the environment into consideration with how my overall health is. So I just want people to be encouraged and to understand that if someone told me, you know, 15 years ago after my grandmother passed away from Alzheimer's, that would you want to know if you have the Alzheimer's gene? I didn't know if she had it or not. I still don't know. But at the time I said, no, absolutely not. I don't want to know that. I just want to live my life and do the best that I can. And now I'm kind of like, well, we know a little bit more about what ApoE does and how that metabolizes certain nutrients. And so honestly, I would like to know, because then I can make an informed decision with my food, with my lifestyle and my movement to be able to take steps in the right direction to prevent what could be an Alzheimer's diagnosis. So I think that our understanding of genetics and epigenetics has shifted a little bit in the last decade, definitely since the Human Genome Project was concluded. And we keep getting new and better research and medical studies out every day. So this field will continue to grow like wildfire, and people will be able to take control of their health and have an empowerment to be able to take their gene report. Potentially, hopefully, people will continue to get trained in this area. They can take it to a practitioner and say, I have my gene report if you're interested in just taking a look at it, and maybe we can kind of work together on this. So it really is a growing field, and I'm so excited to be stepping into it now and to also, you know, be coming into a new career as someone in their 30s to be able to practice this, because there's no better time than now to be stepping into this field.
There's no better time to follow your dreams and your passions either. So love that for you. You sound like you absolutely are thrilled and you are so over the moon, ready to help people in this type of situation with the nutrigenomics, nutrigenetics. And you are very much like you've been through the weeds of health chaos too, which gives you me even more of empowerment and encouragement for the people that you get to work with. So that's so awesome. Now for you, how can people find you and follow you? And then what resources or trainings have been the most beneficial to you?
Yeah, I have a website, rootandfruitnutrition.com. You can follow me on Instagram, same Root and Fruit Nutrition. And then I have a Facebook page. So I am currently trying to get my ducks in a row to get my private practice going. So hopefully later this fall, I'll be able to start taking clients and patients to start seeing them. And then some of the resources I recommend, I mentioned Amanda Archibald's courses. I love Christine Houghton's work out in Australia. She does some amazing research with sulforaphane just to encourage good gene expression, especially with methylation. There's some really good genetic companies, 3x4 Genetics or 3x4, MaxGen Labs, DNARX. There's so many. And again, the field continues to grow with both practitioner-only tests as well as direct-to-consumer tests that are available. So yeah, I think there's some great podcasts out there. I've been enjoying Yale's podcast for 3x4 lately and just kind of learning from all of the practitioners that she has on her show, just like you. So it's been a lot of fun to research on my own.
I absolutely love that. I'm all about self-research, self-learning. So that's amazing, Sarah. And thank you so much for taking your time to come on my podcast to share your wisdom and your knowledge, because I know my listeners are just so excited to just continue to learn and learn. So I'm very thankful for you. Now, where can they find you? Where can they work with you if they would like to?
Yeah, I would just send them to my website, the rootandfruitnutrition.com. And again, later this fall, I'll be able to start taking clients. I'm not quite ready yet. Still working on that part. But until then, they can listen a little bit on your podcast with some suggestions I have. And then hopefully I'll get to meet with them soon.
I love that. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for taking your time to come on my podcast and share your wisdom. And you guys, I hope you all have a blessed rest of your day.
Thanks, Lacey.